Welcome to Ungagged. In a while, we're going to have Deborah Torrance on not saying the C word. That is, the disease that Boris thinks should be just released into the country with little checks, other than people panic buying bog roll and singing the national anthem over the sink. Natalia Urban will be speaking on, she's going to be giving a review of a book by the SNP founder, Robert Cunningham Graham. The book's called A Brazilian Mystic, Being the Life and Miracles of Antonio Conselheiro. And then I'm going to be speaking on some of the real heroes of the Northern Irish Troubles. And Richie Venton is going to be speaking on keeping the pressure on the council, that is Glasgow City Council, regarding Blair Vattick. Richie Venton was one of the organisers of the Save Our Schools campaign about 10 years ago, and he speaks about the need for an expansion of outdoors education rather than the present retraction, and talks about the effect of Blair Vattick and Outdoor Pursuits residentials on children's development. This was recorded before Glasgow City Council decided to kick the closure into the long grass for now. It's included here, as all of what Richie says should go towards any decision on what happens next. I want to apologise for the lateness of this podcast. Some of us have had a busy 20 years, and our campaign to have the leader of the Liberal Democrat Tories kicked out of Scottish politics before Christmas was exhausting. Add to that, my father dying at the end of January after an illness. We decided to rest for a while. But here we are, back and invigorated. And in the coming days, I'll be releasing a new format for us. We're going to have a Coffee With series. And the first one will be a coffee with Kevin Gibney of Independence Live here in Scotland, and Michael Cullen, an SNP city councillor. I spent more time in Northern Ireland than I have done for about 20 years. I usually go, I'm usually over a few times in the year, but for no more than a week at a time. This time, because of my father's illness and then him dying, I was there for probably in total more than a month. And driving back and from Banbridge, my hometown, to Daisy Hill Hospital in Newry, I passed a few places I knew were places that people met dreadful deaths at the hands of violent political ideologues, few being as poignant as the place where the Miami Show Band were attacked and three members were killed. More about the Miami another time. It's something that I would like to return to. And more about one of the survivors of that attack in a wee while. But I want to talk about ordinary heroes of the Troubles. Ordinary heroes I'm very thankful for, who during the Northern Irish Troubles kept bread on the table and did so under threat from all sides. And I'm remembering ordinary workers who felt fear and were maimed or killed by terrorists during that time while doing ordinary jobs. And I'm remembering some of my own fear of the time as well. One such hero was a man called Werner Wolfgang Heuback, a man who kept the public transport in Northern Ireland running and went on the front line to do so, carrying bombs off buses. I just watched a BBC Northern Ireland documentary about him and the heroic people whose jobs were to do no more than drive buses. It brought back lots of memories from the time. If you want to watch that documentary, it's a series called Frontline on BBC Northern Ireland. You'll get it on the iPlayer. And this particular one was called Buses on the Frontline. But the biggest memory that came back while I was watching it was sparked by an interview with Werner's son. He told of his worries as a child of his father at his work. A worry I had, especially when I was old enough to realise what was happening in Northern Ireland, and the realisation quite young at how the terror organisations and political players cared little for ordinary people's lives, especially if their ordinary lives could be exploited or got in the way of some political goal. Bus drivers such as Harry Bradshaw and Sidney Agnew, who lost their lives due to nothing more than working to ensure their families could afford food, electricity, heating and a home. Look, please Google these two people, Harry Bradshaw and Sidney Agnew, they were heroes of the trouble. They really the real heroes were not the politicians and the flag wavers. Heroes were those who struggled on through terrible times for their families. My father was one of many thousands of unsung heroes of the Troubles. When I realised he worked as a joiner, as a foreman, on building sites in areas that almost daily appeared on news bulletins, I became scared for his life. My dad drove a bright yellow Farren's van. They're a construction company, I think from Sweden, but they seemed to get the contracts for all of the housing executive work that was going on in Belfast during the 70s and during the 80s. But he drove that van to and from Belfast, from Banbridge every day. He drove through many different areas across borders, peace lines, collecting and leaving off workers on the way. Dad was well respected and liked by those he worked with. One of those people he drove to and from work ended up in jail. And when my dad passed away earlier in the year, we found letters from jail from the man who praised his friendship. Dad really had little interest in sectarian division. He worked on both the Shankill and Falls and other places as equally as divided and religiously ghettoised. And we had to change our phone number to ex-directory because of the threats made to him. When he had to do his job and maybe pull up people from all sides for their work. On one occasion, a young worker who had asked to redo something he'd not done well told him he was now a marked man. It was a we know where you live speech, one that folk now say in jest, but one that was a dreadful threat coming from someone who could well be a player. Dad was like many ordinary people in Ireland in the situation of having to do the firm's dirty, dangerous work and hand over protection money to the paramilitaries. So on this occasion, when doing so, he reported the threat to the IRA commander who picked up the money. The commander told Dad not to worry, as he and the other construction workers were building houses for the people. The young guy came to work the next day and he apologised to Dad. On another occasion in a loyalist area, on handing over the money, a well-known loyalist terrorist opened his jacket to reveal a gun. My dad said, what have I done? How fucked up society was when workers were so much on tenterhooks that they had to watch their step in case of some perceived insult to fanatical sensibilities. The terrorist, laughing, opened up the other side of his jacket to reveal a bottle of whiskey, a present for Dad, and said, I'm only joking, Bobby. When the terrorists drove off, Dad went into the site office, opened the bottle and took a few swigs of the calming spirit, some joke. There are a few stories I could tell about my dad and the threats he and his ordinary work gangs suffered throughout that time. I worked with him as a labourer on occasions, and I witnessed the handover of the cash a few times, and I visited terrorist HQs with him on occasions as well. And I remember driving through peace lines and past cordoned off crime scenes and devastated, bombed out homes and workplaces. And I remember the laughter and the crack in that van. I remember in the early 80s, long conversations about electronic music with a young joiner, and I remember the shouts and the whoops of the men in the back of the van as Dad raced the newly built DeLorean cars as they were tested along the M1. And I remember as a young boy watching the 5:45 news to see if Belfast featured as Mum cooked the dinner. I felt then worried sick for my dad, but I held it in, crushingly inside. I'd tell Mum, Dad might be late because there's a bomb, stroke shooting, stroke incident, stroke riot, etc. in Belfast. And I'd stand behind our living room curtains, anxiously watching the road for a sign of that yellow van. And I remember the elation I felt when my dad returned home and he sat in the kitchen with his plate of spuds, radio on, and unfurled Belfast Telegraph. I worried so much about my dad all my life and in recent years about his health. But how do we heal a generation of grown-ups who were put through mental torture by ideologues who targeted or disregarded ordinary workers? My dad, although he would never show it, worried about what was going on. Just look up the Kingsmill Massacre or TBN and other incidents that targeted ordinary workers for putting bread on the tables of their children, and you can understand why. Like quite a few people who lived through this horror, this terror, this fear in Northern Ireland, I resolved not to let it get in my way. I had friends who were from all corners of our broken society. I partied across peace lines and I drank with UDR men in their bases and Sinn Féin members and student digs in various areas of Belfast. And I crossed all the borders. When I look back, I wonder if I hadn't have left Northern Ireland in 1993, would I have become collateral in the hands of some ideologue or other from either side? The murder of two friends, a Catholic and a Protestant in Points Pass, was carried out by someone who drank in the same company I did, which was a mixed crowd of Banbridge Catholics and Protestants. Education, as always, is the key to stamp out ignorant hatred that leads to the enemy being a bus driver or a joiner earning a wage in order to raise a family. This is why I support wholeheartedly that survivor I was telling you about of the Miami massacre, Stephen Travers. His Twitter is at Miami Showband. Anyway, he's trying to create a space in Newry, the place where I went back and forward every day to visit my dad in hospital, for truth, a Truth and Reconciliation Centre. And if you also look up on Twitter at TAR_platform, you should get lots of information there, and you still also get a link to where they're trying to raise some funds to get that centre off the ground. I wasn't shot, I wasn't blown up, but like many children of the Troubles, there was an impact that stays with me through what I experienced both emotionally and physically. I was threatened and I was attacked a few times, and I did see bombs and I did see things, horrible things. Things happened to me for being in the wrong place and for saying the wrong thing to the wrong people. But I got through it all without, you know, much injury and whatever. But my dad and our family suffered loss throughout the Troubles, as did thousands of people. But we all suffered fear. Everyone suffered fear. Everyone in Northern Ireland, across our visible and invisible borders, and some people, ordinary people heading out to ordinary workplaces, suffered fear because of their jobs and because they crossed the indiscriminate paths of gunmen who could at any time pronounce them as collateral or collaborators. So at this time, I'm remembering Werner Heuback and my dad, Bobby Scott. No one has a monopoly on suffering or loss. This is the brilliant Fran O'Toole and the Miami Show Band with Fire and Rain.
Just yesterday morning, they let me know you were gone. Susan, the plans they made put an end to you. I walked out this morning, I wrote down this song. Just can't remember who to send it to. I've seen fire, I've seen rain. I've seen sunny days that I thought would never end. I've seen lonely times when I could not find a friend, but I always thought that I'd see you again. Won't you look down upon me, Jesus? You gotta help me make a stand. Just gotta see me through another day. My body's aching, my time is at hand. I won't make it any other way. Oh, I've seen fire, I've seen rain. I've seen sunny days that I thought would never end. I've seen lonely times when I could not find a friend, but I always thought that I'd see you.
mouth through an easy time. My back turned towards the sun. Lord knows when the cold wind blows, it'll turn your head around. And now is the time on the telephone line. You talked about things to come. Sweet dreams and flying machines and pieces on the ground. I've seen fire, I've seen rain. I've seen sunny days that I thought would never end. I've seen lonely times when I could not find a friend. But I always thought that I'd see you again.
Hi, I'm Deborah Torrance from Ogai. How are you doing? Do you have a fever? A cough? A crippling sense of panic and desolation? Don't worry. We still have an awesome NHS for now. And if you're worried about your health, you can call NHS 24. In fact, you probably should. Panic is infectious and all. I tried to buy some hand sanitizer gel at my usual place and they didn't have any. I looked online and the prices shot up like fireworks in November. Are people unnecessarily panicking about this? Or is this new flu-like respiratory illness with a 3.4% mortality rate, according to WHO, a truly deadly global pandemic? Is this the real apocalypse? Or will climate change and Mother Nature still kill us all first? Government advice has been a bit confusing. Maybe it's cause the UK, with now 80 cases, is in fact four different countries with different healthcare systems. To wear a mask or not to wear a mask? Is hand sanitizer gel really as effective as just washing your hands when you can? I don't know anymore. What I do know as pictures of paramedics in full-body hazmat suits are a bit scary, and various social media posts about pharmacy shortages of Carex sends eucalyptic shivers down my spine. Is it now okay to say, "Wash your hands, you boggin' bastard," when somebody walks past the sink on their way out the public toilets? I thought that was always acceptable. Here's my advice. A wheelchair-using, bog-and-flare-wheeling, autoimmune disorder person in the vulnerable-to-death category. Panic! Now is the time to panic. Do it internally, though. Just be more vigilant washing your hands and don't post big, lengthy social media updates about shaving your beard off so your mask fits better. I get beard envy. Stay healthy. Stay calm. Stay ungagged. Remember, if you like what we do and think we maybe need some sanitation of our own, consider donating to us. You can find the link along with stories, articles and reviews on our website at leftungagged.org.
You're listening to Ungagged, Left Voices, unfiltered, unedited and ungagged. You can join in the conversation with us on our website, leftungagged.wordpress.com, on our Twitter, @_ungagged, or on facebook.com/ungagged.
victories shall come my way tonight. Little victories shall come, shall come. Little victories shall come, shall come.
Hi everybody, Natalia speaking. How are you? So I am a bit excited about recording the pod today because I'm gonna speak of something that is kind of like myself, a mix between Scotland and Brazil. Today I'm gonna talk, like making a wee review about the book A Brazilian Mystic, that it was written by Robert Cunningham Graham. For those that don't know who he is the founder of the SNP. That's right. He has written a book about Brazil. Curious, right? So when I discovered this, it was like around 2014, soon after I moved to Scotland, like I became sort of like obsessed about like discovering like connections between Scotland and Brazil, especially because it was like a form to me, it was like some sort of a way of feel like a part of the Scottish society. So when I came across the book, it took me a while to actually find a copy. And it was like a very interesting book because it tells a real story about the Canudos War in Brazil. Canudos is, it was, how can I explain? It was a religious settlement that was located in the Bahia, the Sertão region, that I think it can be translated as the backlands. And it is a extremely arid region where people struggle until today against poverty, drought, and political schemes, corruptions. So the Canudos was a movement, a messianic movement, a religious movement that was led by Antonio Conselheiro. And even though it happens around the 1893, I guess, I don't remember now, and it was in the end of the 19th century. But even though that happened there, there are some scholars that said that it might be the configurations, the distribution of powers, and the way how Antonio Conselheiro led the community, that they might be perceived as a proto-Marxist society. I never like studied profoundly about that, but what I know came about the movement came from mostly about literature. That it's something that I'm gonna speak more about it in, because the story Brazil has had in his in the country's history several popular rebellions, like that's the way I can put it, but Canudos became one of the biggest ones because it was a rebellion that became a book. It was a book called Desertões, and I think English can be is translated as The Rebellion in the Backlands. And there it's a realistic book, that it's a huge book that tells the story about the conflicts and the whole war and how the society worked inside Canudos and their resistance. It's a very anthropological book, if and very journalistical one as well. And inspired by that, Robert, or like I like how I like to call him, Don Roberto, and he read that book. He never he lived in Brazil, but he never went to Canudos because it was like before his time in Brazil. And he read the book and he wrote his own book, Brazilian Mystic, inspired in the Sertões, or the rebellion in the wet, in the backlands. And his book is very interesting, even though like it's much smaller than the Sertões, because the Sertões is almost like the size of a Bible. Robert's book, it focuses a lot of the racial configuration of the people in the backlands. What is that people? I think it's because for the point of view of an European, it might like be some sort of like fascination of, because they are not from anywhere, like they are a mixed of a bunch of different people that went in Brazil. Like many people in Canudos back then, they were slaves that were set free. They have like people that were mixed raced with indigenous, some poor European immigrants. So they have Don Roberto likes to put like they have like interest mix of people, but not just in their appearance, but in their behavior as well. And because he focused a lot of the book in the religions experience of the Canudos community, because after all, Antônio Conselheiro was a religious leader. It's interesting that in that region in Brazil, we have many religious legends that are almost, again, using the word anthropological, explanations for what they are living through, like why they have to endure so much hunger and thirsty and poverty. So they have like religious explanations, like almost like legends to explain that someday they are like waiting for something or some being to come and save them. And Don Roberto speaks a lot about that. And what is very interesting is that I was talking about like the racial component, is that I perceived in the Brazilian book that inspired Don Roberto, they used the term of racially degenerate, like the Brazilian writer Euclides da Cunha used it a lot, like to say like they were like, and I quote, like mongrels, but even though they were like mongrels without training, without like proper weapons, they succeed in winning many battles against the Republican army in Brazil. While Don Roberto does that distinction, that the racial profiling of the people, like explaining the how they are, what they are. Of course, nowadays it would be like considered problematic, trigger warning for those interested in read the book. It might sound a bit racist sometimes, but even though I'm Brazilian and I came I am descendant of people from the backlands as well, I can say that I understand that was a different time. Of course, it's no an excuse when like people are alive, but in the case, in his case, he's not, and it's a book, so we have to take those things in count. I think, at least, it's my humble opinion. And Don Roberto seems to have some sort of sympathy for the oppressed people there. And I don't know, but something, as I said, as my mix that I consider myself as a Brazilian Scottish person now, I can see that, I don't know, maybe this might have some sort of influential for him, like in the future, to see how an oppressed people might be willing to fight, might be willing to, I don't know, challenge the power and their overlords, because Brazil was like a republic for just a minute. They were like recently a republic, and basically when the republic was stated in Brazil, the people, especially those in that lived far away from the city centers, like Rio, like São Paulo, like the beach area of Brazil, and Minas Gerais, of course. Like when the people that lived far from where the money was in Brazil, they basically only knew about the state because there was always a soldier there, like to charge them, to ask them for money, for taxes. So besides that, they did not have any like knowledge, or the government was like offering them any assistance whatsoever. So it's very interesting to make that parallel. At least I might be a bit precocious, but in my head, I think that something that Don Roberto saw in Brazil in Latin America, because he traveled around other countries in Latin America. Something that he saw there might, I don't know, like not just like waking something on him about like Scotland, but I think like influenced his opinion in the future, like to see, well, they are also a poor oppressed people. They are fighting with much of less than what we have here in Scotland. I don't know, maybe that's might be one of his influence, at least in my head. I like to think so. But the book is very good. You can find it for free online. It's a bit tricky to read online. You can probably, I don't know, I never like went to like bookstores here, but Scotland has so many amazing bookstores that you might able to you might find in one of them. But I would definitely recommend that for people wanting to understand not to understand, because I in the historical the things like in the worldly sense of history, Canudos was not a big deal, but in Latin America was a big deal. And an interesting fact that when Lula left prison, he said that during his jail time, he was reading a lot, and he realized that we should be more in Brazil, more in touch with those historical figures like Antonio Conselheiro. And he quoted Antonio Conselheiro by name, saying more people need to understand what Canudo was. That was a movement of people challenging a corrupt power. So it's important for those like wanting to know more about popular rebellions in Latin America, because it was a proper rebellion. Unfortunately, it was also a bloodbath, as many things are in the world. But for the worldly sense, it's not like in comparison with other other rebellions, other movements we had in Latin America. Even so, in Brazil, it's not that big. but I would say that everybody here in Scotland that had that at least have the faintest interest in Brazil should be reading that book. If you are an SNP member, you also should be reading, because Dom Roberto was not just a politician. He was also a very gifted writer as well. And I believe that many of his trips around the world make me to believe that the independence movement, the way that is now, that it's mainly open for others, is mainly wanting to take the best of the people willing coming to Scotland, willing to contribute, came from his experiences like traveling the world and such. So let me know. I'm on social media. You can find me on social media. Let me know if you have like any doubt on the book or things of this sort. If you want to see like a more proper review of the book or something like that, and I would be happy to write for you guys. So bye bye.
This is Richie Venton, the former coordinator of the Glasgow Save Our Schools campaign, speaking on the issue of the Blairvaddick Outdoor Education Centre being shut down by Glasgow City Council. The decision by the SNP-run council to shut down Blairvaddick, I would go so far as to say, is not just a scandal, but a crime, in particular against the most deprived children in the city. It's the last remaining Glasgow City Council owned outdoor education centre, and it's something which really has a huge effect on the lives of thousands of people over the years since it was opened.
When I first moved to Glasgow, one of the first things that stunned me, frankly, perhaps just because I was new to the city, was the fact that a number of people had never been outside their own immediate residential area. That was particularly the case in the most deprived housing schemes, that they hadn't been to neighbouring districts throughout their lives. Now, of course, it's good to have a pride in the area that you grew up, but it's bad to suffer a narrowness, a narrowing of your horizons and your experiences to the extent that you don't know other parts of the city, let alone the wider country and Scotland. But over the years of being here, on and off, I've heard many adults talking about their experiences as children in going to Blairvaddick while they were still at school, and always it's been spoken with fond memories. The poorest kids in particular, this is the first introduction to the countryside for them, and in particular, and certainly, the first experience of the Highlands, where they got a 1 week residential outdoor education at the age of 10 or so. It involved climbing, orienteering, walking, water sports, canoeing and things like that. And also, not just during those outdoor activities, but also of an evening, other exercises in team building, in life skills, even basic things like cleaning up and washing up and all that kind of thing, getting themselves ready. And the social skills that are developed in such an environment, the friendships that are involved and developed, the self-confidence that grows for children at that formative age when they're put in a situation where they're in residential proximity to other children that they might not have known that well beforehand. Supervised, of course, by professionals, teachers in those skills. It's an enjoyable experience from all the accounts I've had. It's a memorable one. A lifelong memory, in fact, is implanted and has a huge impact on the personal and academic development of all those who've gone to it since 1974. All the activities that children go through at the Blairvaddick Centre are well beyond the reach of most of working class families. Now, there are other privately run centres, of course, but the charges, the fees, the cost make it well beyond the reach of most families. And therefore, this centre is a critically important part of growing up. And now what we have is the City Council set to deprive the most deprived communities of this experience. When I was the coordinator of the Save Our Schools campaign about 10 years ago in Glasgow, it was to conduct a campaign against the closure of primary schools and nurseries by the Labour-run City Council. And one of the main arguments that we made at the time was for local schools to be retained with smaller class sizes, but also to be within a healthy, safe walking distance for children to go to school, to get into the habit of walking and also to have the exercise that goes with it. Labour, by closing down many of the schools, despite our efforts, we saved some of them but not most of them, deprived thousands of children of that experience. Schools became more centralised, more distant from people's homes, less accessible on foot. Now, the SNP have taken over, and despite all their grand declarations of standing up for Scotland and standing for change during the course of the elections, they're now carrying on the same old habit that Labour had of wielding the axe at the expense of those most in need of the services that the council has provided. So we had years of the Labour-run council slashing education, shutting down schools and nurseries, making them less accessible for children, making it unhealthy to get to school because it wasn't within walking distance. Now we have the grotesque spectacle of an SNP-run council with the backup of all people of the Scottish Green Party councillors deciding to shut down Blairvaddick. And what makes it even more outrageous is the fact that the savings, so-called, are a minuscule total of £130,000 a year. That's all they're saving by this atrocity, this vandalism against the health, education and personal development of young children from deprived communities. And frankly, it's totally unacceptable, and the SNP and Green councillors should be ashamed of such a measure and reverse that decision. Blair Vaddock is the latest in a long litany of closures of outdoor centres across Scotland. And it flies in the face of all the evidence of the social and educational benefits that such places have. Outdoor education is increasingly recognised as being better than children just being stuck indoors in a classroom. There's experiments increasingly in the Scandinavian countries with outdoor education. There's examples even in this country of the likes of nurseries having education literally outdoors. And even the Scottish Government's own curriculum for excellence declaims in favour of outdoor education, including residential trips, to be available to all children. That is completely in contradiction to the measures of the Glasgow City Council, run by the same SNP party as the Scottish Government, who are now shutting down that opportunity for hundreds, in fact, over the years it'll be thousands of children if this closure goes ahead. And the feeble excuses being trotted out by the ruling group of councillors, that they're going to have a different model, incorporating local parks as part of the outdoor education, is just not good enough. Of course, that should be part of the educational experience. Of course, local parks and day trips and half-day trips and walking trips to local parks should be part of what children enjoy during their nursery and primary education, for example. But it's no substitute for a residential outdoor centre, because that introduces thousands of kids to the joys and the health benefits of the countryside, as well as the social benefits I've mentioned already of coming together, being in residence together for the course of a week and not just going out for a couple of hours in a local park if they're lucky. Scotland already faces a mental health epidemic. That's well recognised. The government's investing increasingly in mental health as an issue amongst, for example, young people at college and university. In workplaces, mental health is increasingly a curse on the working class, which needs to be countered, and which the trade union movement is doing its best to take up as an issue. And we even have the situation of the Minister for Mental Health and Inequalities, Claire Hawkey, moving an emergency motion next month on this very issue. But how does that square up to what's been done to Blair Vaddock? It doesn't. Because the mental health benefits of the countryside are widely recognised by the professionals in that field for improved stability, for improved mental balance, for tackling things like stress and anxiety. And that certainly starts at an early age. And it's widely accepted as well in reports by professionals and experts that outdoor physical activity is one of the things that helps to combat the outrageous health inequalities between the different classes, between the rich and the poor, the working class and the upper middle class. That outdoor physical activity, as enjoyed at the likes of Blair Vaddock, is something that helps to give working class people a chance, a slightly more level playing field when it comes to their health prospects. Now, on top of that, there are something like 40 jobs at risk. And those workers only heard about the plan to close the place a few minutes before the actual budget meeting. That's in keeping with the fact that the trade unions representing thousands, tens of thousands of workers in the council were never once informed, let alone consulted, about the overall budget plans involving some like £42 million worth of cuts. There's talk of ensuring redeployment of the staff at Blair Vaddock. And of course, as a trade unionist, and a socialist. I hope that's successful. But frankly, I don't want it to be successful because I want them to stay in the job. I want them to stay at Blair Vatic because I don't think we should allow it to shut. And even if redeployment was on offer, there's no denying that closure is criminal because this centre needs to be kept. So it must be fought by the staff, by parents, by communities, by former users of Blair Vatic during their childhood, and by teachers. And that raises another scandal for me, because there's been diktats issued by the education chief in Glasgow City Council, Maureen McKenna, that the teachers and other employees must remain silent on this issue. In other words, be gagged. I think that's a disgrace and must be exposed. So regardless of their attempt to gag and silence the opposition, they won't succeed. There's a growing opposition to this because people recognise the values of this outdoor centre. And I think also, frankly, the demand should be that it's free at the point of use and not just a subsidised charge for use of Blair Vatic Education Outdoor Centre. So to sum up, it's criminal that there's talk and plans to close it down in June and to cancel the trips that children have got lined up for later in 2020 and 2021. It must be fought. It must be saved. It's a critical part of people growing up. It's so important for city children in particular to have that experience of the countryside on a sustained basis. You know, for example, a week's trip. I grew up in the countryside. And frankly, as a teenager, like a lot of people in rural areas of Ireland, I couldn't get out of the place quick enough and then became a city dweller. But as somebody who's lived in the city for the remainder of my life, frankly, I need the countryside. And that applies to children. They need that balance. We need a greater integration between city and rural life. We need the experiences of both. We need children to be able to escape the stresses, the strains, the cramped conditions and the narrowness of being hemmed in just in one classroom or hemmed in one housing scheme, and to get out for a while to the countryside, to the Highlands of Scotland, and to learn something about the country that these children actually belong to. So save Blair Vatic, stop this butchery and unite against the cuts in general. Thanks.
You'll find lots of other podcasts and articles on our website, leftongag.org. It would be fantastic if you could donate to us at paypal.me/ungagged left. Cheers. See you later. Bye.